Good evening, everyone. Last week, we finished talking about the numerous early treatments applied to severe mental illness, most of which were more just means of controlling patients than really fixing their mental illness. Even the one that did work required shocking the brain of a patient, which is generally not something anyone wants to do if they can avoid it. But finally, starting in the 1950s, we began to have medications available for the treatment of psychiatric symptoms. Let's talk about how that came to be. To start, we're going to go back in time a little bit to the late 1800s, where asylums were using morphine as a medication in order to subdue their rowdier inmates. In case you're unaware, morphine is an opiate drug, and so while the patients probably didn't mind this approach too much, many of them did eventually become addicted to the drug, which is not quite the outcome you want in your mentally ill patients. But, like other treatments of this era, morphine does not reduce psychiatric symptoms, it just makes patients easier to manage, and also addiction is bad, so alternatives were sought out pretty quickly. The first drug often prescribed to psychiatric patients outside of asylums was called chloral, like a combination of the words floral and chlorine. Chloral was a sedative that was used, like the morphine before it, to knock out patients who were being rowdy, and also to help induce sleep, which for anxiety or depression patients with insomnia was actually kind of useful. Chloral could be given orally instead of by injection, and it was not an opioid, so less addictive, but as it turns out, still kind of addictive, which is not great. Beyond that, it also supposedly tastes terrible, gives you bad breath, and later would be discovered to potentially cause cancer. Definitely not a great step forward even from morphine. However, chloral saw a lot of use in the 1900s as a drug for psychiatric patients. Putting a patient to sleep while not really enhancing their conscious experience does reduce symptoms kind of technically, you know? When you're asleep, you cannot be anxious or delusional or exhibit abnormal behavior. And so, desperate as they were for treatments, some psychiatrists thought that maybe putting patients to sleep more could help reduce their symptoms while they were awake too. In the early 1900s, a psychiatrist named Neil McLeod experimented with what he called deep sleep therapy, putting patients to sleep using sedatives for extended periods of time. McLeod preferred a sedative called sodium bromide, though, over chloral, which also has a bunch of nasty side effects. Coma, cardiovascular problems, or respiratory arrest were all possibilities, and one of McLeod's patients actually died during his experiments. Dosing sodium bromide is also really difficult, and so sometimes patients would end up sleeping for a full day or two longer than was intended, which feels like a very wide margin of error to me. But that's not all. Sodium bromide also causes toxins to build up in your liver, and so the more it's used, the more damage it does. Basically, medications were mostly just being used to put patients to sleep, which did technically help with symptoms while they were asleep, but was not a real reduction of psychiatric symptoms. But nobody really expected that in the 1950s, the first medication that actually reduced psychiatric symptoms would appear on the scene. That drug is called meprobamate, and it would become known as the first tranquilizer drug used for psychiatric purposes. Meprobamate came about from the work of a scientist named Frank M. Berger, who was working in England in a lab trying to find a preservative for penicillin. By coincidence, he noticed that one of the chemicals he was working with seemed to calm down the mice, rats, and guinea pigs that he was using. He described this effect in a 1946 article, and this type of drug came to be known as a tranquilizer. Some years later, once Berger had moved to an American firm in New Jersey, Berger and another chemist named Bernard Ludwig created a similar tranquilizing drug, but with a few less drawbacks, which became known as meprobamate, although it was sold as Milltown, named for a town near their lab. I think it's a bit of a weird drug name, but clearly the public of the 1950s did not agree or care. The drug was put on the market in 1955, and initially sales were pretty lackluster, but the company that put it out was actually hesitant to put it on the market at all, and didn't bother much with marketing. But later that year, Hollywood discovered the drug, and meprobamate became part of the culture, with many celebrities using it and openly advocating for its use. Within literally a year of its release, 36 million prescriptions for the drug had been written. And keep in mind, the US only had about 170 million people back then, so that is a lot of prescriptions. One out of every three prescriptions in the US then was for meprobamate, and about 1 in 20 Americans had tried the drug by the end of 1956, which is a crazy fast adoption. The drug was given for just about anything, probably partially because it was one of the only effective drugs around. And although I doubt many younger people like myself have ever heard of the drug, meprobamate was clearly a big deal at the time. Unfortunately, by the late 1950s, it also became clear that the drug Miltown was somewhat addictive, and sales began to drop. But at this point, it was pretty clear that there was a lot of money to be made. Those 30-plus million prescriptions made their manufacturers a fortune. The companies that sold meprobamate made at least $40 million in 1950s dollars, which, if you account for inflation, is well over $1 billion in 2021's money. And that's just from one drug. Pharmaceutical companies took notice, and so even as meprobamate specifically fell out of favor, other similar drugs would quickly step in to fill the void. But we will save that for next week, when we discover some drugs that you probably actually have heard of, regardless of your age. As always, thanks for listening. If you'd like to contact me, please use any of the links in the show notes. Thanks also, of course, to Jojo Tang for editing, Angie Lee for our cover art, and MuseOpen for this music.